So how long we got? Where's our destination today?
I don't know. We got 20 miles to cover. Let's talk some movies. People don't know how to drive.
Are we going to get lunch on this gig? You seen anything good recently?
Not really. Right, we got a little time, Steve. Let's do a podcast.
Sounds good.
Driving around.
I'm Steve Haskin.
I'm Andre Shane, and we are here for part two of our television podcast.
That's right.
And, Steve, you know, we were talking last time about our favorite shows on kind of broadcast television, and, you know, I started thinking generally about, like, why is this such a good time for television? Are there
sure.
factors in play that make TV so good now that weren't in play before? And, you know, obviously one of these factors would have to be the presence of the streaming services that kind
yes.
of operate similar to the premium cable channels. You know, like, there was sort of television before HBO, and then HBO came along and had these fantastic shows like Oz and Sopranos that really changed the way television was viewed by audiences, you know, and now there's these streaming services that can follow pretty much the same pattern, which is to say there are no limitations, there's no broadcast limitations in terms of content. So that kind of creates an atmosphere where, like, cooler shows are possible.
Yeah, the other thing about the streaming services, which they, somebody picked up on the fact that you know, starting in the last decade, where they started to make whole seasons of TV available on DVD, people would spend a weekend, just kind of hold up, and they'd watch a whole season of television in just, like, 3 days to a week. You know, binge-watching.
Binge-watching, a new phenomenon.
Well, it didn't used to be possible, you know?
Sometimes
there would be, you know, depending on the day or the time of year, certain cable channels might have, you know, you could watch 4 episodes of Seinfeld in a row or something. But there wasn't, it was kind of unusual
that
you would be able to watch.
VCR.
Yeah. One of the, and I don't know about you, but the first show that I really heard about people doing this with was 24. Like,
yes.
People seem to really enjoy, since the concept of the show is that, you know, 24 episodes over 24 hours.
Real time, people
yeah,
are
like,
watching it.
Well, let's try it out. Like, and I know a lot of people who spent a weekend just watching 24.
I can't do that, Steve. Have you ever done that? Well, what's the
no.
closest you've come to binging a season?
Not, you know, anything like that would be something my wife, it'd be a show she would enjoy, and she has about, like, 3 hours in her max. So the closest I've come is maybe I've done, you know, like, 8 episodes over 10 days, but not, I never did one of those, like, hole up and just, let's just watch TV for it. Actually, you know, I want to take that back. We've done Twin Peaks marathons.
Oh, really?
I've done the whole 12-episode first season of Twin Peaks before in a day.
Impressive.
Yeah.
Impressive.
It's a spooky day.
Yeah, I bet it is, man. There's a lot of creepy stuff going on that show. And it's, you know, what's cool about binging, of course, is now you can do that again. You can go back to shows you used to enjoy
sure.
back in the day and kind of binge out on them and just see if they hold up, and Twin Peaks certainly holds up.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because, like, I do think the quality of shows is better. So when you try to binge on old series that you were enamored with when, you know, when you were younger, like, I tried to binge on Miami Vice a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, Miami Vice, like, when Miami Vice is good, it's still very good. But, you know, with Miami Vice, like a lot of these older shows, you had 24 episodes a season.
Yeah.
And that forces a lot of that, you know? I mean, they have to do episodes devoted to kind of lamer side characters and you know, just have storylines that are inconsequential and are kind of throwaways. And now with both cable shows, and it's starting to get like that with network shows as well, but certainly with streaming series, they really don't go over 12 episodes.
Yeah, and that's, well, there's two things in play. Number one, what we were talking about the last time, too, with especially the HBO and other high-prestige dramas, a limited number of episodes, which means that you have this kind of a closed story arc, and, you know, everything is assumed to just be the one chapter in, like, a 12 or 13-episode story. Whereas, as you said, in a larger, you know, when you have your standard network 22 to 24 episodes, you might have a whole episode that's just, like, an aside. You know, it's just, right. Like, there's a master narrative for the season, but, you know, like, our master narrative covers about, like, 18 episodes. So then we got, you know, we might have a little 10-minute bit of it on episode number 19. But then, hey, what if the side character took a trip to Vegas? That's an episode. Yeah. You know, you got to fill the hours.
Yeah.
But with the streaming stuff, not only is it the limited number of episodes, but they just skip the middleman of parceling it out. And, like, hey, people like binge-watching. Well, these networks like Netflix and Amazon, the whole season of a show is available at once.
Right.
So it's just like, hey, if you want to watch season 3 of Orange is the New Black this weekend, it is all available. It's not like you don't have to wait. Bam, here it is. And there's good and bad things to that, which we can talk about. I mean, on one hand, you get your binge-watching fix. But the other thing which is interesting, I don't know if you've found, is it just eliminates the whole traditional water cooler effect.
Yeah.
There's no anticipation anymore.
Right. Suspense is over. You know, the cliffhanger thing becomes difficult, you know, because you're instantly, like, if there's a cliffhanger at the end of an episode, like with 24, I mean, every end of an episode was a cliffhanger, basically.
Sure.
But if you binge watch it, you just go to the next episode, and you figure out what happened, you know? So that's the downside. But honestly, it's one of the few downsides.
It is.
To me, I think it's cool to be able to watch the show at its own pace. And it also, because shows are so driven by showrunners, so there's almost like an auteur situation happening in television, where there's a showrunner whose kind of point of view most shows follow from beginning of the series to the end of the series. Obviously, that sometimes people get fired and so on and so forth, I think. The Walking Dead by now has gone through like 4 different showrunners.
Yeah.
But you know, most other shows have kind of a vision behind them, a continuous vision, and that's very, very different from a lot of the series from the past.
Yeah, it's just interesting though. It's I think kind of an unintended side effect is it really makes the viewing less communal in a way. That if you watch these shows, you know, you can talk about it with your friends, but you never know when they're going to watch it. You know, if you have a friend who's into House of Cards and you're into House of Cards, like, it's not like you can show up on Monday and be like, hey, did you catch House of Cards last night? And so it's everybody spacing out.
That's true.
Whatever, you know, the advantages you and your spouse or whoever you watch with, you can pick it to your lifestyle, which is awesome. But
the flip side, of course, you can have viewing parties. You know, you could say, hey, you know, come over and we're going to watch like 5 episodes of House of Cards or whatever that is. Speaking of House of Cards, you know, that's kind of a big Netflix show.
Well, that was the first one, I believe.
No, the first Netflix original series was Lilyhammer. Now, Lilyhammer, have you seen Lilyhammer?
I thought that was a Scandinavian television production.
No, it was a co-production with Netflix, and it was Netflix's first original series.
Uh-huh. I did not know that.
It does have that honor. Now, Lilyhammer was not quite the runaway success of the House of Cards, so I think a lot of people kind of attribute the success of original programming on Netflix to the House of Cards, and that's probably correct. You know, it's because House of Cards was much more successful than Lilyhammer. Lilyhammer's a cute show.
Uh-huh.
It stars Steven Van Zandt. He plays kind of like an over-the-top gangster character, similar to the guy he played on The Sopranos, frankly.
God bless Steven Van Zandt, but not exactly who you're looking for range.
No, not a lot of range in Steven, but the show is a lot of fun and quirky, and, you know, if you can accept the fact that people speaking different languages understand each other perfectly. And so that's one of the conceits of that show. Like, when he speaks English and everybody else speaks Norwegian, they have a conversation, and you just have to read one side of the conversation with subtitles. Sadly, Lilyhammer, as cute as it was, did not quite get the viewership, so it got canceled. But it did spawn other series on Netflix, and of course, House of Cards was the big one. How are you on House of Cards? You like that?
You know, I've not really watched much of it. I've only seen bits and pieces there. I know it more for its historical significance. Not only was it kind of the first, got a lot of press for the streaming, but wasn't that show, like, genetically engineered in a lab? Like, they analyzed a lot of data that, I'm serious. Like, what, I thought Netflix analyzed their viewers' habits and were like, well, people like David Fincher movies. People seem to like movies with Kevin Spacey in them. People have been watching The West Wing. Why don't we make a political show directed by David Fincher starring Kevin Spacey?
Yeah, I wasn't aware that the show was
not making that,
that
up. Like, it's
they like focus grouped it to that extent. Well, you know what? They did a good job, because certainly, at least for the first couple of seasons, House of Cards is super cool. Like, it's a fun show. It's an engaging show. Kevin Spacey really is, like, at his best. Kevin Spacey is a little bit hit or miss as an actor, I think, in a sense. Like, he's always great, of course, but not every role that Kevin Spacey's in really plays to his strengths.
Sure.
With House of Cards, boy, that Frank Underwood is right in Kevin Spacey's wheelhouse. I mean, that character is nefarious, he's Machiavellian, he's funny, he kind of monologues to the camera through a lot of the series. House of Cards is a little bit of a Macbeth thing, you know.
Sure.
That's basically what House of Cards is like. Also, it's important to point out that House of Cards is based on a BBC television series from the 80s that I tried to watch, but it was just too 80s for me, and too British. So those two things, I was like, I'd rather watch the American House of Cards at this point. It's also much more relevant to what's going on in Washington. Even though it's not strictly, you know, like you mentioned The West Wing. The West Wing was very topical. House of Cards is less so. House of Cards kind of takes place in a much more fictionalized world of D.C. It's not a mirror image of Washington. It's sort of a Shakespearean image of Washington in a sense, you know. But it's such a good show, and it's got such good acting, and it's beautifully shot. I came as close to binging it as I've ever done to any show. I mean, I remember, I think there was a day where I watched 5 episodes of House of Cards, and that was all I could really handle in the House of Cards thing. But the thing about House of Cards, though, the third season of House of Cards, I didn't even finish watching that yet. I mean, I'm slugging through it because I actually don't like it. I think House of Cards has gotten quite a bit worse. I'm hoping that the next season will kind of realign the show and make it better, because it's lost me, I have to be honest.
Well, it certainly got a lot of buzz and people talking about this, like, wow, so Netflix is just jumping in, like, really in a big way, and it kind of opened the floodgates after that, then there started to be a lot more Netflix shows, there started to be shows on Amazon, shows on Hulu.
Right.
And what's some of the other interesting streaming stuff you've got there?
Well, I mean, on Netflix, you know, Orange is the New Black was a big show. Orange is the New Black. I mean, I actively dislike it, so I don't watch it. And I mean, it's you know, my issue with Orange is the New Black is that I literally hate every character on that show. I find every character on that show to be, like, actively irritating. So
it's tough watch, then.
I stuck with Orange is the New Black for about 5 or 6 episodes, and then I no longer wanted to watch Orange is the New Black. So I'm not really an expert on that show. I know some people love it. I did hear that it got quite a bit better in season 2. So that's always good to see that sort of adjustment made. And that's another thing that Netflix can do, because of the way the shows are delivered, is that they can kind of they can focus group it in a sense.
Well, they can adjust. Again, this is both a pro and a con, that they certainly have a lot of freedom to adjust it between seasons, but unlike a network show, there's not going to be any adjustment within the season.
Right.
Like, it's, you know, season two will arrive fully formed, and you take it or leave it.
That's right.
If there's something people don't respond to, well, too bad. That's there.
Yeah.
And but it does lead to some more interesting choices, I feel, that sometimes people don't, you know, there's not that network suit second guessing.
Right, right. And the other thing that Netflix actually does pretty cool is Netflix is has a capability of using its production umbrella to pick up shows from other countries, you know, and that's sort of an interesting thing, or shows that have more of an international vibe. So, like, one of my all-time favorite Netflix shows, Peaky Blinders, which I believe is basically a BBC show?
I think so, yes.
And it's kind of a prestige BBC show, but it didn't quite have the vibe that a lot of other BBC shows get, that get picked up on BBC America or go to PBS. It's a little bit harsher than that. It's a little bit more edgy. Now, Peaky Blinders, for those who haven't seen it, it's basically a very classic kind of gangster genre. It takes place post-World War I in Birmingham, I believe, and it revolves around these kind of Irish gypsy gangs. And it's really awesome. It's Cillian Murphy is the star of it. And that guy, you know, he's been a lot of good stuff. I've never particularly...
Yeah, I love him.
I was never a huge fan of his, but, man, he is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of his. He's a really interesting actor because he's a, you know, he's a high cheekbone, very attractive, somewhat androgynous-looking guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also got that Irish toughness in him. So, you know, like,
yeah.
I feel like a guy who looked exactly like him who was from America would just be the wispiest.
Yeah.
You know, he would have a whole string of playing models or male prostitutes or something.
Or guys that get raped in prison a lot.
Exactly. Whereas, and Cillian Murphy is interesting because he can play those roles.
Is it Cillian, Steve?
I think it's
Come
Cillian.
On.
I think it's Cillian.
Is it? I think it's Cillian. You know what? We'll agree to disagree.
All right, yeah. Mr. Murphy has played those roles. There's a Neil Jordan role where he plays a transvestite.
Sure,
person.
Sure.
But he also can play kind of sometimes a tough with an edge to him, which I...
Well, he's got a whole lot of edge in Peaky Blinders, and he's, you know, and he plays one of those strong, silent types on that show.
Yeah.
Which is also kind of against type, it seems like, for him, and he's excellent because he's really good at, like, not doing a lot in terms of expressing what's going on, but at the same time being very expressive somehow. The character really reminds me of kind of like what Pacino did on the Godfather movies in the best possible way. Like, he doesn't say much, but he says a lot, you know? And that show is really cool. Again, it just has a fantastic cast. Sam Neill is on it. He's kind of the antagonist on the show. He's excellent. And there's only two seasons of it, and because it's a BBC show, it's even shorter than a normal streaming show. So Peaky Blinders only has 6 episodes, which is kind of cool, per season, you know?
Yeah, BBC are famous for it. They get in and get out.
Well, it's very easy to catch up on a show like that. So if you're a fan of the gangster genre, Peaky Blinders is really something worth seeing. I think the thing that show has going against it is that it's called Peaky Blinders, because what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
Now, the show obviously clearly explains what that is, and once it gets explained, it's like, oh, that's actually pretty cool. But the name is a little bit of a, I think, barrier for people because
it's
hard to guess what the hell.
You know, I have not started watching that. I keep meaning to, based on your recommendation and others. And I will say that is the most British title I've ever heard of anything in my entire life.
I mean,
even Downton Abbey sounds more American. I mean, Peaky Blinders.
What the hell is that? It's weird. I think it's like one of those cases where what it is specifically is the name of a gang. But even more specifically, it's something having to do with what this particular gang kind of specializes and what they wear. Just seriously, watch it. It's really a fantastic show, especially if you're into crime dramas.
You and cannot gorgeous, go wrong. Right? With it. I've heard
it's beautifully shot. It has a fantastic soundtrack. You know, this is one of those shows. It's a period show, but it uses modern music, and it's almost entirely scored by Nick Cave and PJ Harvey, a couple of our favorite musicians.
Yeah.
So a lot of that anachronistic use of modern music, a lot of that shit does not work, in my opinion, in a lot of movies. But on that show, it works like, whoa. It works stunningly well. I absolutely love the show. I could probably devote the entire episode to talking about it, but I won't. I'm just going to recommend that people watch it, especially if you're into the genre. And on season two, of course, one of the antagonists on that show is played by Tom Hardy.
Uh-huh.
Who's batshit crazy on that show.
Yes.
And
big favorite of ours.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a great performance. It's a funny performance. It's got a lot of nuance to it. And it kind of like, it's like after the first season, I didn't think Peaky Blinders could get any better. And in season two, it actually gets better.
The answer is add Tom Hardy.
Add Tom Hardy to the mix, and it will get better.
It probably improves most things in life.
He does.
Might improve, like, my dinner. Like maybe my trip
like
to the grocery store.
Like you invited him
yeah,
over?
Exactly.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that would work out well, actually. But
I don't know. Just insert Tom Hardy into various situations.
As a performer, definitely.
As a performer,
As an individual, I don't know. He kind of frightens me a little bit on a personal level. But man, as a performer, he's fantastic. So watch that show. It's definitely one of my favorites. And we talk a lot about superhero genre, and for years we've been saying, like, you know, the superhero genre would be perfect for television.
And
they listened to us.
They did. Netflix last year gave us Daredevil.
That's right. Daredevil, a show that's, like, perfectly tailored for television.
It sure is.
It's especially tailored for television that has no editorial limitations on it. So Daredevil is a fairly gritty show, man.
It's a crime show. I mean, if anyone listening is unfamiliar with the Daredevil character, he's a vigilante. There's certainly some Batman elements to him, but
yes.
The character is Matt Murdock is a lawyer who is blind.
That's right.
But
as a bat.
Yeah. But his superhero power is that his similar to a real life blind person, his other senses are heightened.
Yeah.
But he also has kind of, they always described it in comic books as almost a sort of radar. So while he couldn't look at a picture and describe it to you, he's aware of like where things are around him spatially. So one of the gimmicks is that as a vigilante, the people who's fighting, you know, are unaware that Daredevil is blind. Like, they certainly know that Matt Murdock, the alter ego lawyer, is blind, but Daredevil, the superhero,
right. He
can kind of fake it.
Yeah, he absolutely
can. So it's a crime show. It's a good thing. It's really interesting. They take full advantage. It is the darkest, most violent, grittiest Marvel property out there. It's kind of impressive in a way that Marvel, who seems to have such a, at this point, is very much a template for their movies.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not the case with this Daredevil show.
No.
There's a couple side remarks that acknowledge how New York was fucked up by the Avengers.
Yeah,
but,
it is part of the Marvel Universe. It's
which
large,
is in some ways interesting because it's a very dark, gritty show. It has one of the more, I think it's one of the more realistic portrayals of what it would be like to be a secret vigilante at night.
Yeah.
In that Matt Murdock goes out and he fights crime and he's fighting people who fight back.
Yeah.
So even if he wins, he is often bloody, bruised, wakes up the next day. He's tired because he's been out half the night. And he kind of looks like shit, stumbles into work a little worse for wear. And I'm a big fan of Daredevil. It's not a perfect show, but I am pretty impressed with what they did.
Yeah, I'm impressed as well. It's got great action on it. The martial arts, you know, it's important to point out that he's not just a blind guy who decides to battle crime. I mean, he's like a trained ninja.
He is trained.
That's the
thing.
So he's a trained ninja
also
who happens to be blind
with
a little bit of a slight sensory superpower. But he doesn't have super strength. He's a guy, you know?
Yeah, the superhero element's actually pretty tiny.
Yeah, yeah. There's not a lot of superness going on in that show. And they also don't really get him into any kind of silly costume until the very last episode, I have to say. And I also got to say that, you know, if there's any weakness on the show that I'd point out, is that that costume needs some work. Because I don't think it looks particularly good. I think they need to tweak the costume for season two, because I'm not crazy about it.
One of the other things about Daredevil, and most of... The show follows the template of the comic books in that Daredevil's greatest enemy is not, a wacky supervillain. His greatest enemy is this guy called the Kingpin, who is just a gangster. I mean, he's the way he's conceived is he's just a very powerful New York gangster. The show goes that, and it's got a fantastic...
He's also a real estate developer. He's sort of like Donald Trump, really.
He's like a real... He's a real-life gangster, and that he's... like most real life gangsters, their primary interest is making money.
That's
it's
right.
not, you know, they'll make money through means that you or I, and especially the law, might disagree with.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're into making money.
Yeah.
And the Daredevil show has a fantastic, interesting performance of the Kingpin by
Vincent D'Onofrio.
Oh,
my God. He's so good, man. And you know, we got to give props to Charlie Cox, who is a British actor who plays Matt Murdock.
He is great.
He's excellent.
Yes.
I mean, and it's cool that they cast a guy. They did not cast a guy who looks like Matt Murdock in the comic books. I mean, Charlie Cox does not look like Matt Murdock, because Matt Murdock is kind of a ginger guy, you know, and Charlie Cox is a dark-haired Brit. But whatever, it doesn't matter. Charlie Cox is great, but Vincent D'Onofrio, who only comes into the series about episode 4 or 5, even.
Yeah.
And the show is good up until that point, and then Vincent D'Onofrio comes and elevates the series to another level, because he's so interesting on that show and so weirdly sympathetic.
Well, yeah, like the best villains, he's a fascinating guy, and a lot of times you think he has a point.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
Sometimes when he's explaining his rationale for certain things, you start to get sucked in. And then every other episode, though, he does something rather horrific.
Right.
That reminds you that he is still the villain of
that's very true. But it's really cool. And you know, what I really like about Daredevil also is that if for people that don't like the superhero genre, you could pretty much watch Daredevil and enjoy the crap out of it.
You could, yeah. I think it'd be more of a, if you're a fan of like martial arts and crime stories and New York, and that would all.
And even the legal genre.
There's a legal storyline,
you know? The storylines, and there'll be more of them because, you know, because he sort of operates on both sides of the law.
Well, that's one of the things I always liked about the Daredevil character, is that you get the sense that Matt Murdock was trying to fight injustice on various fronts. The lawyer front is not just a cover. You know, it's almost like the vigilante aspect of his life was supplemental.
Right.
You know, like saying Superman, like, you know, it's not usually a lot of great Superman stories about Clark Kent's journalistic career, you know?
Right, that's very true.
Although, originally,
in the old days, that was a huge part of the character.
But for the most part, it's
right.
the significance. Yeah. And for most superheroes, you know, that a lot of times their non-superhero identity is just a cover.
Right.
But in Daredevil, you know, Matt Murdock is very present as a lawyer.
That's right. I mean, and there was always a lot of legal aspects.
A lot of lawyering.
A lot of lawyering, exactly, in the comics. And that's cool. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the next season of Daredevil. Of course, they're going to get the Punisher and probably Elektra. So, you know, some of the more...
Daredevil's got a lot, like, one of the advantages of building movies or shows off of comic books is that in some of these characters, I mean, there's 50 years of material to pick and choose from.
Right. And Daredevil really has some of the greatest comic
some good
books,
storylines.
Story arcs that are grounded in reality and are emotional and just very well executed. I mean, the comic book Daredevil really came of age in the 80s, where comics sort of became more mature.
Shout out to our old friend Frank Miller.
That's very true. One of my all-time
favorites. A little bit crazy these days, and unfortunately maybe ill, but God bless Frank Miller.
Yeah, that's very, very true. And so that, you know, and you kind of feel it on that show. So definitely Daredevil is the thing to watch. And there'll be other Marvel shows coming from Netflix. So that'll be interesting to see what those are like.
Yeah, it was good that that was successful.
Yeah, it was crazy successful, I think, and huge numbers. I mean, overall, I mean, Netflix is really kicking ass. Why didn't I invest in their stock when it came out? I don't know what the hell's going on, man. I think I'm missing it. But, you know, now there's other streaming services kind of cutting in on the Netflix territory. And I think the best of them seems to be Amazon Prime, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, Amazon Prime didn't have a lot going on. And then they got this show. It was kind of sketchy. Like they would try a couple of shows for, like, a pilot. Like, Amazon Prime started doing things a little differently from Netflix. And one of the things they did differently from Netflix is they would release a pilot, see how the response on the pilot would be, and then do the rest of the series. Ah. Which is very different. Like, Netflix doesn't do that.
Netflix
just puts out the whole...
Here it is.
Like, they're committed, you know? Whereas Amazon kind of wants to, like, stick their toe in the water a little bit more, you know? And I don't know how well that worked, but the first show where they, like, totally committed to was this show called Transparent. Man, that's a very interesting show. I mean... It's a show about, like, a middle-aged man, or I would say a bit older than a middle-aged man, played by Jeffrey Tambor, who, you know, is transgender, who decides, like, at 70, that he wants to live out the rest of his life as a woman. And the show is about how his family, which includes an ex-wife and his three grown children, how they deal with that. And, it's very interesting. Honestly, it's an interesting subject. I know there's a lot of sort of trans world material out there now that some of it is, most of it is in the reality world, you know, with Caitlyn Jenner or formerly Bruce and all that stuff. But I have a feeling that there's a little bit of a backlash against it. Like, I think people are tired of it. But, man, that show, Transparent, is such a good show. It's funny. It's not a hard drama. It's got dramatic things in it. It's got some genuine emotion. But it's funny. It deals with a humorous aspect of what it's like suddenly discovering that your dad is a woman, you know?
Yeah.
And it's so well acted, and it's quirky, you know? It's got a unique vibe to it that's very, very different than a lot of other comedic shows, you know? It has its own thing going for it, and I really, really like it. That show also, I got really addicted to. It's just something about it that just really, really works, you know? The acting is good, the writing is good, the directing is good. It's very, very good show. Check it out.
The first of these streaming shows were all, like, these prestige dramas, because mm-hmm. those were the first things that were kind of hits on HBO, or at least in this recent age of television, and those were the things that people were binge-watching.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, now they've kind of opened it up, and there's more just flat-out comedies.
Absolutely. Another one that's on Amazon that's an original show is called Mozart in the Jungle, and that's all about sort of the world of the New York Philharmonic. It's a sitcom. And, you know, there's never really been a show that dealt with the world of classical music, like what it's like to be a classical musician. And in this show, apparently being a classical musician is really not much different than being in a rock band, certainly in terms of doing drugs and, you know, having a lot of... a lot of sex with strangers, according to this show.
Wow, I had no idea. That sounds...
Yeah,
it's no idea,
like,
it's so
you
exciting.
Think, like, wow, the Philharmonic world is a bunch of stuffed shirts. No, everybody smokes weed and has unprotected sex. So, but the show is fun. It's got a light spirit to it. It has a lot of good actors in it. Gael Garcia, you know, Mexican actor.
Yeah.
He's kind of the lead in it, but the other lead in it is Malcolm McDowell, who's always a pleasure. To see in anything.
Non-Mexican. Yeah.
And, yes, absolutely. and it's cool. Yeah. It's got a cool, like, New York vibe to it. It reminds me a little bit of Sex and the City, in a sense. You know, it's got that that vibe to it, you know? It's definitely, the central character is a woman on it, so it does have a female perspective, which is cool. And it's a fun show. I recommend it. I don't think that show gets a lot of love for some reason. I don't think
it's a lot of chatter. Yeah, I mean, I got to be honest, I've not heard of it.
Yeah, it's really cool. Amazon also has a show that actually hasn't come out yet. Again, they followed this sort of a pilot thing. And that show is based on a great book by the legendary Philip K. Dick, a science fiction writer.
Sure.
Who wrote the books that Blade Runner is based on. And I mean, he kind of invented modern science fiction in a sense, you know. And one of his most challenging books is called A Man in the High Castle. And it deals with sort of an alternate reality where World War II is won by the Nazis. And Man in the High Castle is now a show on Amazon. The pilot episode is up now. The rest of the series is up in November.
Uh-huh.
The pilot episode is excellent. I mean, excellent. And that is a challenging show to do. And when they knock the pilot out of the park to the level that Man in the High Castle is executed, I'm very excited about the rest of the series. And I really can't wait to watch it. So keep an eye out for that one. And you watch anything on Amazon?
I don't. I haven't signed up for the Prime service.
The Prime
so
service
I don't
is
have the yeah, but
I tell you, Prime is a great, it's a great value.
We are. I've thought about, especially with holidays coming up, that we might sign up for it, and then I'll watch Transparent.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, Prime just, you know, because with Prime you get free delivery, basically, which very quickly adds up to what you're paying for the Prime service, and on top of that, you get the Amazon Prime viewership, you know, the streaming service, and that's pretty good. And again, they're doing really cool stuff on it. And another thing that Prime is also great because they've acquired all the old HBO shows.
Yeah.
So now,
Prime, really?
Yeah.
So it's not just HBO streaming. Nice.
That's right, man. I mean,
nice.
They're a little bit stingy with the Game of Thrones.
So
if you're expecting to watch Game of Thrones on Prime, that's not gonna work out for you. But if you want to watch the entire series of Rome, a great show, Deadwood, a great show, Oz, a great show, Sopranos, a great show.
Nice.
It's all there for your benefit. It's all there for your benefit. And
this segment of Film Driven brought to you by Amazon Prime.
Yeah, so we'll check that out.
You should. But what are you into now? What's exciting you on the
streaming world? There's a couple
world?
Interesting comedies I like. First of all, I really enjoyed the Wet Hot American Summer series.
Ah, back to Netflix.
Yeah, yes. Back to Netflix, which had Wet Hot American Summers, if anyone's unaware, was this cult movie from either 99 or 2000, right around then. And I was a big fan of that movie. And there was talk for years they make a sequel, and what they did was they made a prequel to the show, to the movie. It's I think it's like an 8 or 10 episode series on Netflix. And it's really great. It's not for everybody, but what I appreciate is how it kind of maintains its own quirky identity. And
right.
Some of the jokes are intentionally dumb, but one of the overall jokes, which Andre, frankly, just keeps working for me, is that in Wet Hot American Summer, when they made that movie, you know, it takes place at a summer camp.
Right.
And all the counselors are played by actors, most of whom were around 25, pretending to be, you know, like 17 to 19-year-olds.
Now, you're talking about when the original movie came out.
The original movie, yes. The original movie, so these people played a little bit younger than themselves, which, you know, a lot of them, it was a bit of a stretch. But, you know, Hollywood's famous for this. You know, like 90210 was a teenager.
Right.
Well, in the new Wet Hot American Summer, it's great. It takes place before the movie, except now it's 15 years later. So now we have actors who are like in their mid-40s pretending to be even younger teenagers and with no makeup to really help the Like, they're not trying to fool anybody because it's a comedy. And I have to say it worked. In particular, Michael Showalter, who was basically the lead, he was the lead of the movie.
Well, he's also the main writer, right?
Him and David Wayne. He's one of the co-creators of the whole thing. He was the lead of the movie. He's exactly the lead of the show, but he doesn't look real great these days. He's kind of bloated, and they give him a horrible wig.
Grand,
no, well, he's less so now. And but yeah, the show it's really cool. You don't have to watch the movie to appreciate the show.
No. I'm totally with you. I never saw the movie. In fact, I shouldn't say that. I started watching the movie. I didn't get it. It didn't click with me comedically. But I did watch the entire Netflix show.
Did you enjoy it?
I love it. And now I'm going back to the movie.
Oh, yeah.
I love the movie, too. I get the joke. And again, not all of it works, but some of it is so fucking funny. When it works, it works. The laughs are huge. Yeah. A lot of times, there are not a lot of laughs.
And you can tell that Wet Hot was, not only do the people who made it have a lot of famous friends, but you will recognize a lot of faces on the Wet Hot show. There's a lot of big names. And some of it even, there are people like, say, Bradley Cooper, who when Bradley Cooper was in the original movie, he was no one.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And he's funny in the movie. Yeah. But he was no one. And nowadays, you know, Bradley Cooper is probably one of the 10 largest.
Well, he's one of the biggest stars in the world.
Yeah,
yeah. He's beyond up and coming.
He's not too big to return to that Wet Hot role.
Oscar nominee. Yeah. Probably more Oscar nominations coming for that guy. Yeah,
delighted to return to the goofy Wet Hot world.
Absolutely, and hilarious again on the show. There is such a funny game. You know, the whole thing about the age thing on that show is hilarious because, you know, not only are the main characters played by 40-year-olds, like Janine Garofalo is probably 50 now, you know, and it's kind of hilarious to watch her play a teenager, but also, not only are they played by 40-year-olds, but also there are still kids who are actually the age of camper kids.
Yes.
So there's this weird mixture of, like, adults playing kids and actual kids playing
kids.
Well,
they even extended some of the roles to, and what I thought was pretty generous of Michael Showalter and David Wayne, they extended the reunion. Hold on. I think you have to get out of this lane. I could be wrong about that.
I don't care.
Okay.
keep going.
They extended the reunion to a lot of the non-famous people. Like, there are people who were legit teenagers from the movie.
Right.
Who now are, you know, 28, 30, but now they're playing campers. So you do have, a mixture of actual teenagers, sometimes people maybe as young as 12.
Right.
And then you have people reprising their roles from the movie.
I know.
Except, now they're clearly adults.
Yeah, my favorite gag in that movie, and I hate to give it away, but I will actually give it away, and this is how they sort of justify it. Like, there is, the beginning of the series, there's a girl, and she's played by, like, a 14-year-old girl.
Sure.
You know? And I guess it's time, like, she's just starting to have her periods, and the other characters are kind of starting to, like, try to talk her through this traumatic change. And basically what happens in the show is they take this little girl and they take her. She walks into the washroom. They kind of talk her through it, through the door. And when she walks
she's in
out
the
door.
Stall. Yeah.
That's right. She walks out of the bathroom stall, and she's now played by a 35-year-old actress.
Yes.
So that was the change. That's how they do
They're like, oh, honey, you're a woman now. And she's really a woman. It's a great gag.
I love that. I absolutely love that. It was fantastic.
I mean, moving on a little from Wet Hot, one of the other interesting things is some of these streaming services, it's just another outlet for people who can't get things on the networks. For example, I watched this show called The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Oh, yeah.
Which
That's
is
an
a,
original show,
It's
right?
a Netflix original, co-created by Tina Fey. It's got an interesting premise. Have you seen that show, Andre?
No, my daughter loves that show.
Well, it's got a really interesting premise that it starts out that it was, there was a group of women who were held in a bunker by a strange religious cult-like person, and they escape.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's like, what do they do with their lives? And one of the women, Kimmy Schmidt, she gets invited to New York to be on the Today Show, and then after that she decides she's just going to stay in New York. So it's the adventures in New York of a woman who spent the past 15 years, literally in a bunker. And it's a wacky comedy. Well, it's an interesting concept. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about the show is there's nothing about that show that could not be a network show other than the fact that no network agreed to air it.
Right.
So Tina Fey, and I'm forgetting the name of the co-creator, had this idea for a show. They probably shopped it around. And Netflix was the only people who bit. But, I mean, I watched the show. And there might have been a curse word here or there, but it's a 30-minute sitcom. You know, like, it follows sitcom rules. There's nothing, like, there's not crazy nudity, you know?
Right, right.
And, it's a solid show. It's a good show.
I'm fine with my daughter watching that show.
Yeah.
She loves it.
Yeah.
And, absolutely loves it.
Just another outlet.
I should watch it. You think I'll like it, Steve? You think I'll like that?
You might. Did you like 30 Rock?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was 30 Rock is pretty good. I mean,
I haven't seen the whole season of it, but it's pretty funny. It's good. Not a, you know, like wall to wall, and a lot of it's got some contrived sitcominess.
Uh huh.
But
sure.
There are some jokes that really land.
Right.
And yeah,
it works out good. You know, while we're back on Netflix, you watched Bloodline, right? You started watching that.
Yeah, I started on Bloodline.
Bloodline is a great kind of a soap opera that's on Netflix. Again, 10 episodes. It stars Kyle Chandler and Ben Mendelsohn, and there's lots of great people. Sissy Spacek is on it. I mean, it's got a great cast.
Well, and it also takes place down in the Florida Keys.
Yeah, which is a weird setting.
It's a great... I mean, like, my parents live in South Florida, and South Florida is a weird place full of strange crime. There's a whole, like, you know, subgenre of crime fiction now that all takes place in Florida all the time.
It's a crazy place.
I'm frankly surprised there haven't been, you know, since Miami Vice, there's been a distinct lack of Florida drama.
There is. I mean, I think Dexter took place in Miami.
Okay.
That was the other Miami show. But I mean, yeah, you're right. But this is not Miami.
No, it's even farther south. Yeah.
So this is really kind of small towny, but it's kind of, there's still, like, rich people. There's a big, like, divide between the rich people and the poor people you know, and it's real southern,
and it's isolated
in some cases, and it's basically islands or
correct.
A series of islands. It's really cool, and it's just an interesting, like, a family soap opera. It totally just, I mean, it follow, and I don't mean to damn it with that praise, it's just really engaging. It's interesting. It's grown up. The performances are frigging great, man.
That's the thing. I mean, some of the characters on paper sound like things you've heard before.
Yeah.
You know, there's an older, like, kind of a more, an elderly couple, or at least, you know, a couple in their 70s, mm-hmm. don't want to offend anybody, mm-hmm. the mom and dad, and then they have their adult children,
right.
some of whom have, like, teenage children at this point. But, you know, so the adult children, there's the very responsible son who takes care of everything.
Or who you think is a good son.
Yes.
That's Kyle Chandler playing the Kyle Chandler character.
Kyle Chandler's fantastic.
He's a fantastic guy.
I mean, like, it's great. And then there's the fuck-up brother who can't seem to do anything right, who's played by Ben Mendelsohn, who's just phenomenal.
Yeah, Ben Mendelsohn is fucking genius, I think.
That role, in other hands, might be kind of a boring character.
Oh, totally. But he makes it interesting, and you both hate him and love him at the same time. I mean, there's so few actors that can do that these days. The Ben Mendelsohn is an Australian guy, and he sort of made a career out of playing these characters that are less than savory, shall we say.
Yeah.
And I think the first time I saw him was in a movie called Animal Kingdom, which is actually a kind of a kick-ass Australian crime drama.
Yeah, that was his big kind of claim to fame that really launched him.
Well, you know, it's at least in America. And he's been in a few other movies, and including one of my favorites from a few years ago called Killing Them Softly, where he actually played an Australian guy for a change. But very similar character, kind of a sleazy, scummy guy who's still kind of lovable in a weird way, you know, and... he's just awesome, and he did get an Emmy nomination. So
good for
he didn't
Ben
win,
Mendelsohn.
But he got it, and I think that was a great thing that he got it, although I have to say that it's almost unfair to give him the Emmy nomination and not to Kyle Chandler, because what makes Ben Mendelsohn so good is his interactions with Kyle Chandler.
Yeah, those two guys are great.
It's just like a dance. It's like watching two great dancers do their thing on the floor, you know. It's really cool. So really recommend it, and, you know, again, watch the whole thing. See how you like it. The second season is coming soon, so that's exciting. And now, of course, the big show that everybody's talking about, at least amongst my friends, is Narcos.
Narcos, yeah.
Narcos is like, it's like an American, French, Colombian co-production, and it's all about the cartel wars of the 1980s. And the central figure is Pablo Escobar.
Pablo Escobar.
And, you know, he's played by this Brazilian actor named Wagner Moura. I've never seen that guy. He's fucking amazing.
He's really great. Yeah, right. Just the right, like, mix of, like, you know, if you see Pablo Escobar, he's not on the surface a physically intimidating-looking guy. Like, a borderline schlubby in his, like,
schlubby,
appearance.
Not a good dresser.
Correct. But in the show, like, he's got all of that going on, but then there's the quiet menace, and, I agree. I just started watching that show, and already I'm just fascinated by him.
Yeah, he's absolutely fantastic. He you know, I hope he speaks English, because he's got a big career ahead of him. And again, you know, he's not one of those, you know, he's not a conventionally handsome leading man. He just has charisma.
Yeah.
You know, what they call charisma and acting ability. He's also one of those guys who is able to express very much with very little.
Yes.
What may be a turnoff for some people with Narcos, there's a couple of potential turnoffs. I mean, one of the turnoffs is that most of that show's in Spanish.
So yeah, that's, not, I mean, it's unlike, you were saying, Lilyhammer.
So yes. Like,
but, you know, I mean, the show, a lot of it takes place in Colombia or other South American locales.
Yeah, mostly Colombia, yeah.
Well,
and it's filmed in Colombia.
In case anyone's unaware, they speak mostly Spanish there.
Mostly Espanol, yes.
And that's what the show's like. Like, you know, so there's a lot of Spanish. It's all subtitled.
A lot of subtitles. But the subtitles are very good. You know, that's another thing. Like, they really took the time with the subtitles. But the protagonists, or theoretically the protagonists of the show, are these two DEA guys who are Americans. And one of them is kind of a waspy guy. I've never seen that guy before.
Yeah, I haven't either. He looks very similar to other people you've seen. But,
well, he's Hal Holbrook's son.
Okay.
He kind of looks like the younger Hal Holbrook, but he's very good, but he's sort of not overwhelming.
Yes, and the other guy, of course, is played by Pedro Pascal, who played Oberyn Martell on Game of Thrones.
That's right, and that guy's a movie star. I mean, that guy's fantastic.
He was one of the most charismatic people in the previous season of Game of Thrones. If you've not, yeah.
We don't want to give away his story arc on the Game of Thrones, but he really was a breath of fresh air on that freaking show.
He was.
Which tends to be a little bit on the dark side, to say the least. And that dude came in and opened it up with a whole lot of charisma and humor. He's awesome on Narcos.
One of my female friends told me she started watching Narcos, and at first she wasn't sure, and then she informed me that, oh, well, Pedro Pascal, the most attractive man on television, showed up, and then she's like, well, maybe I'll continue watching.
Yeah, and he's great. And I love the way the characters look. Like you know, like, it's almost like the weird, I mentioned Miami Vice before. This show takes place at the same time as Miami Vice was taking place. And it's funny because these cops are not particularly good dressers. And they do have the cheesy mustaches that cops tend to have.
It's a great mustache show.
If you're into mustaches, that show is for you.
Yes.
Right? And it's fun. And Narcos is just fascinating. The other thing that I was going to mention that it may have as a kind of a strike against it is there's been a lot of material on Pablo Escobar in the past few years. There's been a couple of movies about him. One starring Benicio del Toro, which I did not see, and it's not supposed to be very good. And, of course, that character was prominently featured in the film Blow with Johnny Depp from a few years ago. But there's been nothing fictional that's been as interesting as Narcos. And Narcos, you know, again, it's not a show that's trying to reinvent the wheel.
No, that's in terms of the filmmaking and the style of Narcos, it's not blowing you away with its originality. That said, it's just the storyline and everything. It's just so fascinating.
It is. Like,
it really does get into how it all works. And not with, I mean, you can, there's certainly a heavy Scorsese influence on it.
Totally.
And it doesn't quite have Scorsese's, you know, slightly sardonic look at things.
Right.
I mean, people, a hallmark of like Scorsese stuff, like Goodfellas or Casino, is that there's a documentary eye to it, but there's also like a sense of play. And, you know, he can appreciate the humor and the irony and things. And Narcos isn't a particularly funny show,
No, although it does have humor in it.
Sure, but it's
it's not, different.
It doesn't look at things with an ironic eye.
No.
But, it is, I don't know, like you've not seen a fictionalized, really in-depth of, like, how do we get cocaine in Miami?
Yeah.
You know? And,
it is. It's super engaging. It's just well-executed, and it's got, you know, it's got a lot of actors you don't normally see. You know, it's not, like, packed with familiar faces, which makes it kind of fresh and fun. And again, it's all about the execution. That show executes it great, and it's definitely a must-watch right now. I mean, really, really the way to go in the streaming world. What else are you into, Steve? Are you watching anything, like, maybe getting away from streaming for a while? Anything you're into these days that that's exciting you on broadcast TV?
Well,
or
you know, I'm giving Empire a shot.
Really?
To be honest, I am, yeah. Empire is...
I hear it's a fun show.
It is a fun show. You know, it's one of those... I don't quite know how to describe it. It's certainly not a prestige show. That said, like, there's parts of it that are crazy in an interesting way. The season premiere featured a Terrence Howard character, you know, end of the first season in jail, and now he's in jail, and they're holding a rally to free him. And they kind of bring in certain elements of, police protest, Black Lives Matter. It features a shot of his ex-wife descending from the rafters in a cage in a gorilla suit.
Wow.
Then protesting the treatment of African Americans. And, you know, from angle one, that's kind of a crass exploitation of real world problems for this silly show. From angle two, a clap of the hands at the ballsiness of it,
yeah,
you know?
That sounds hilarious.
Yeah.
And it's also a Chicago show. So we got to support it just because it's given our friend.
We've worked with people who work on that show.
Absolutely.
And,
we could probably work on that show if we really want.
That show's got some ridiculous elements to it, but it's really interesting. And it's also, it's a big hit for a show that really takes place, like, you know, far and away a predominantly African-American
show.
Yeah. And I've heard what a lot of people like about that is, you know, even in this day and age, most shows have, like, one or two black people on them. So you're still given this thing where, like, no matter, you know, there's differences in characters, but they're still made to, like, all right, by default, if you have a show where there's only one or two black people, those people are kind of representing black people in the world of the show. Whereas in Empire, there's such a wide swath that, you know, there's 40 different types of black people to watch on the show. And it's just really interesting.
It's an interesting glimpse into another community. I'm not sure how realistic the show is in terms of the recording industry.
It comes and goes. That's what's interesting about it, is parts of it are very realistic. Parts of it don't make any sense whatsoever. You know, like one of the jokes on the first season, it wasn't an intentional joke, was that, you know, they had this record label that wasn't doing real well, and the father's big solution is we need to go public with the company.
Right.
Which, that's not sound financial advice for your record label that when you're struggling. But hey, Empire. I've been checking Empire out. It's an entertaining ride.
It sounds fun. It sounds like a guilty pleasure. And actually, there's a lot of TV shows that kind of fall into that category for me, where I watch them where it's like, I'm not saying that this is some kind of Citizen Kane. It's not on the level of awesomeness of The Sopranos or Peaky Blinders. But they're just good shows. They're dramatically engaging, and they're kind of fun. And I have a few of these shows that I'm really into. Like, FX has a show called The Strain, which, like, if you're a fan of The Walking Dead, The Strain is kind of the vampire version of The Walking Dead, but it's confined to the New York City, which is cool. It's a very New York show. And it's kind of a weird, it's sort of Walking Dead meets Dracula, in a sense. But the vampires are different, and the way it's handled, the whole vampire epidemic is handled more as a, as kind of a viral outbreak. But there are definitely, like, main bad guy vampires that, you know, play a huge part in the whole thing. So unlike The Walking Dead, where the zombies are kind of, they're just like animals that are trying to eat you, the vampires on The Strain are real characters, and they have motivations, and they have stories, and they have histories that precede their being vampires. And I tell you, there's a German actor on that show called Richard Sammel. There's lots of good actors on that show, but Richard Sammel plays this former Nazi who is sort of the right-hand man of the main vampire, who's kind of a, you know, who's more shadowy in the series. Richard Sammel on that show really needs to be recognized for playing one of the best fucking villains on television. That guy is just, pardon the pun, sinks his teeth into this character like nothing I've ever seen. And every time he's on the screen, it's just delightful to me. I mean, he really reminds me... He reminds me a lot of
other Nazi vampires you've loved in the past?
He reminds me of Christoph Waltz.
Uh-huh.
Now, it's interesting because Richard Sammel is also in Inglourious Basterds. He plays the Nazi. He's got a very small role, but it's memorable because he gets killed by the Eli Roth character with a baseball bat.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the guy, right? Very memorable face, and you could easily see him being a vampire with that face, right? And but, man, he's fantastic. He makes that show. And that show also is one of those shows. It started out okay, and it's been getting better. And, like, first season is pretty good. Fun, but, you know, kind of cheesy a little bit. Second season's a lot better. And that show also explores some interesting elements of today's society that are worth exploiting. Exploring, and maybe exploiting as well. I had a slip, but maybe there's something to that. What else do I like that's kind of a guilty pleasure? On Starz, the show called Black Sails, which is a pirate show.
Pirate show.
You know what? Everybody I know who's seen Black Sails is into Black Sails. Black Sails is really worth checking out. The problem is it's hard to catch.
Like, yeah.
If you don't have Starz.
Starz is
a tough
there's
one.
Been other shows we've known and loved that have unfortunately been on Starz and had a short life, like Party Down, Boss.
Yeah. And then those shows, for some reason, like they don't go to other streaming services.
Yeah.
And they just kind of fade, or it takes them a long time. You know, Starz also had Spartacus, which was a fantastic show, which is now actually on Netflix now. So Black Sails will get to Netflix eventually. But Black Sails is executive produced by Michael Bay. Not a person you associate with quality anything, really, for the most part, you know.
Lamborghinis, maybe?
You know, a lot of anamorphic photography, very flashy, a lot of obsession with cars, crazy obsession with military hardware, so on and so forth. Very, you know, it's Michael Bay. But Black Sails is an excellent show. He's not the showrunner. He's just the exec producer. The guys running the show really have their shit together. And Black Sails is not to be confused with the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. I mean, Black Sails deals with the historical aspects of pirates in the Caribbean area, pirates that operated out of Nassau and Jamaica, and it deals with that in a very serious way. And it ties it in with the American Revolution, and it ties it in with the current war on terror, and it's a really intelligent show that also has a lot of TNA on it. And a lot of scenery chewing, of course. A lot of action. It's got a great cast. And I really recommend it. Oh, yeah, and it's also a prequel to Treasure Island. So,
oh, it is.
A lot of people
don't realize that.
But it sort of tells the story of how they got the treasure. Which is, you know, if you're a fan of Treasure Island, and I was obsessed with it as a child, that's a plus. And I'll just mention one more show that I really like. Can I do that, Steve?
Let's do it.
Penny Dreadful, which is on Showtime, I believe, is a horror series, and it's a second horror show.
Takes place like a carnival, right? Or?
No, no, no. That's, you see, people are confused with what it is. Penny Dreadful is, I would say, the closest thing that I would compare Penny Dreadful to is, it's a little bit reminiscent of A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
The comic, not the movie.
Yes.
Okay? Basically, it takes these Victorian era or pre-Victorian era characters like Frankenstein, Dorian Gray, and Dracula to a certain extent, and puts them in this Victorian context and treats them very seriously. The show is very dramatic.
Yeah.
This is not a light treatment. It buys into its mythology fully. It buys into the horror fully. And I'm telling you, that show is genuinely scary. I mean, I'm not a person who is easily scared by movies or TV shows.
Uh-huh.
That show is scary on multiple levels because the horror on that show is not just relegated to creatures of the night, vampires, witches. There's plenty of that. But it also shows the horror of what it was like to live in Victorian-era London.
Yeah.
In terms of dirt, disease, class inequity, the difference between how rich people live and poor people live. It's really an outstanding show. It's tough. It's a tough show. In other words, it's not a show that's going to put a smile on your face at any given time because everybody's suffering on that show. Sometimes physically, but always emotionally, always psychologically. It's got a great cast. Timothy Dalton is awesome on that show. Ava Green, another Bond veteran,
yeah,
is kind of the star in that show. She's a phenomenal actress, really, really deserves a lot of credit, does great, great work on that show. And Josh Hartnett from... Josh Hartnett movies, absolutely. Josh Hartnett is also does the best work of his career on that show. You don't see him a lot these days. He kind of faded away.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's actually a solid leading man, and I think this show is going to bring him kind of back to the foreground, if that's where he wants to be. I'm not sure that's the case with him, but he's awesome on that show. Like, it's just across the board an excellent show, beautifully written, beautifully shot. If you're into the Victorian horror genre, that show is for you. Seek it out. And that's all I got, Steve.
All right. So, yeah, just lots and lots of great TV out there right now. And if you're complaining you're not getting quality drama at the movies or even quality comedy, lots of great options on the small screen or the smaller rectangular screen.
Absolutely. That's right. That's right. The small rectangular screen. And and seriously, it is so much better than cinema per capita, so to speak.
Yeah.
That there's just, it's something for everybody. Great comedy, great drama, great horror.
Still love movies, though. So, you know, maybe the next time out, we'll actually get back to the fall's coming up. We'll get back to some quality movie going. I'm about to, you know, my wife's about to give birth to a baby, so I'm sure I'll have plenty of time to just...
Yeah, buddy, yeah.
For all the
well,
stuff.
You know, I'm sure you'll get to get away once in a while.
That's right.
It's a secret to sanity.
Avoiding your problems.
That's the secret. And hopefully there are a few good movies on the horizon.
I hope so.
And we'll be back to talk about those. I'm Andre Shane.
I'm Steve Askin. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. Let's go.